Top members of President Obama's economic team delivered some unwelcome news to Congress yesterday. They said U.S. companies are unlikely to hire enough workers to bring down the unemployment rate much this year. NPR's John Itzde has more on the lawmakers' response.
The Obama team, which included Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner and Christina Romer, head of the White House Council of Economic Advisers, went before the Appropriations Committee to explain the president's budget. They credited the stimulus package with saving jobs and helping return the economy to growth. But Romer also repeated the administration's forecast of sluggish employment growth this year. She said while job growth was expected to resume this spring, it's unlikely to average more than about 100,000 new jobs a month. And she added this caveat.
It typically takes employment growth of somewhat over 100,000 per month to actually bring the unemployment rate down. Because we do not expect particularly robust job growth over the remainder of this year, we do not expect to see substantial further declines in unemployment this year.
That means Democrats face the prospect of going into the November election with an unemployment rate close to the current level of 9.7% and with more than 15 million people still unemployed or underemployed. While some Democrats praised the administration's effort to create jobs, Marcy Kaptur of Ohio was not among them. The unemployment rate in her state is close to 11%.
I find your testimony dismaying and out of touch.
Kaptur accused the administration of a lack of urgency in addressing the jobs problem.
In Ohio, unemployment is going up. Our food bank lines are growing longer. People are becoming desperate. I am their representative. I cannot politely sit and listen to this and not feel compassion for them and expecting some from you.
Kaptur went on to point out that one in every 10 Americans is now in foreclosure or 3 months behind on their mortgages. She said the administration's foreclosure prevention programs aren't effective. Treasury Secretary Geithner had this response.
This president acted with enormous care and force and speed, something you had never seen in this country or any other country around the world facing a crisis like this.
Geithner acknowledged that housing remains a terrible crisis for many Americans, but he said that the administration's foreclosure prevention programs are now benefiting more than 1 million households.
We're going to do better than that. I agree with you. The banks are not doing good enough.
It is pitiful.
It's an embarrassment
to the nation.
It's 1 million Americans, and it's going to get better.
Republicans were critical, too. Jack Kingston of Georgia told the Obama team that their job creation programs aren't working.
I would suggest to you that more people have experienced Elvis sightings than have seen jobs created by the stimulus program. And if you guys think it's working, I suggest you go out to the main street of America and talk to the people.
The White House has asked Congress for additional job creation initiatives. Both the House and Senate have passed programs, but they need to be reconciled before they can be signed into law by the president. It's not clear they'll do much to improve the employment situation in time to help the Democrats in November. John Itzde, NPR News, Washington.
Now, a tale of standing up to the Goliath of global finance. For years, the International Monetary Fund has been a big advocate of free market capitalism. Governments that dared to challenge the IMF model found themselves out of favor in Washington and other Western capitals. But the financial crisis that swept the planet in 2008 prompted a new debate over free market policies and IMF ideology. And NPR's Tom Gelton is here to tell us that on one big issue at least, the IMF is actually backed down. So, Tom, a setback for free market philosophy?
A partial setback, Linda. The free market model is still mostly alive and well. But there is a story here about governments challenging an important part of the capitalist system, having to do with capital itself, the way capital moves around the world.
By capital, I take it you mean cash. You mean money.
Right. In this case, capital is money. And remember, Linda, for an economy to grow, it needs workers and it needs capital. Money to build factories, buy equipment, pay the workers. Put the two together, you get a boom. The traditional view is there should be a totally free market for capitalists in this situation. Investors should be free to move their money to some country to take advantage of an opportunity. And when they lose interest, they should be just as free to move their capital back out. The other view is that these capital flows need to be regulated by governments.
Regulated. So that means restrictions on how capital flows around the world.
Right, because as it turns out, you can actually have too much money going into a country. I talked about this with the economist John Ralston Sowell, who wrote a book called The Collapse of Globalism. He explained how this capital overflow problem gets started.
A couple of guys in New York or London who have far more capital than they know what to do with simply dump it into a country.
Other investors see those guys putting a lot of money into some country. They figure it's a good bet and follow their example. Economists call this herd behavior, like when you pick a restaurant just on the basis of seeing other people eating there. So in one year, 1996, investors sunk about $65 billion into just four countries, Thailand, Indonesia, Malaysia, and South Korea, way more than those countries needed, says John Ralston Sowell.
And when you've got too much money and nothing to do with it, you start doing really foolish things. So one of the things you do is you start buying and selling companies for no particular purpose. You start saying, let's put all those companies together. And then you say, let's take all those companies apart.
The price of those companies in U.S. dollars goes up. The dollar price of just about everything in those countries goes up because so many dollars have come in. Governments borrow even more because dollars are so cheap. Then all of a sudden, the first little hint of trouble.
Things may not quite be the way they seem to be.
Ishwar Prasad is a former IMF economist, now at Cornell University. In this situation, he says herd behavior kicks in again, but this time the herd panics.
So when they see a couple of investors pulling a lot of money out of their country, they wonder, maybe there is something going on in this country that I don't understand. I better take my money out before I take big losses.
This is exactly what happened in those four Asian countries. Capital inflows first came to a screeching halt, then went in reverse. Economist Jagdish Bhagwati of Columbia University says that in 1997 and 1998, those four countries had a net outflow of about $20 billion.
People started leaving in droves, you see, creating a massive crisis.
Across East Asia, economies collapsed. The interest costs on dollar debts soared. Local stock prices plummeted. Some governments, like Malaysia, felt burned by foreign investors. They imposed limits on capital movements, both in and out. No more free flows. That set up a confrontation with the International Monetary Fund, which was still arguing there should be no controls on capital flows. Capital should move freely according to supply and demand. Malaysia got portrayed in Washington, in IMF circles, as backtracking on free market reforms. Jagdish Bhagwati says there was also IMF pressure on India, which had never allowed free capital flows.
The Indian finance minister at the time told me that he was continuously being told in the, you know, when he went to Washington to go ahead and liberalize the capital account.
In other words, lift all controls on capital inflows and outflows.
And he said to me, if I had said, no, I don't want to do it because it's risky, then I would have been considered to be not a proper reformer. So he gave the usual answer, which smart people do, which is that, yes, it's a jolly good idea. We are studying it and we're looking for an appropriate time to do it. But of course, he didn't do it.
Professor Bhagwati was on India's side. In 1998, he wrote an article for the journal Foreign Affairs titled The Capital Myth, disputing the notion that economic growth required uncontrolled capital movement. It was not well received in Washington.
The IMF actually reacted violently to this and got their public relations officer to write a comment on it.
The comment appeared in the following issue as a letter to the editor titled The Capital Truth. That was 1998. 10 years pass. Another international financial crisis comes along. This time, Eastern Europe was hit the hardest. Like the Asian countries a decade earlier, East European governments had allowed foreign capital to flood their economies. As for the countries that insisted on capital controls, well, the IMF Research Department took a look at their experiences, and guess what? Jonathan Ostry is the deputy research director.
What we find in our work is that countries that did have some restrictions on capital inflows tended to come into this crisis with more equity, less debt, and this served them well in terms of having less of a credit boom, less of a run-up in asset prices in the good times, and therefore less of a bust in the bad times.
Quite a turnaround. Austria was at the IMF back in 1998, but he doesn't want to talk about that letter criticizing capital controls.
That episode is not at my fingertips right now, but I would just underscore again that, you know, I think our line right now is pragmatism rather than dogmatism.
Pragmatism rather than dogmatism, the new IMF creed. Austria, who laid out the IMF view in an official paper last month, says the change has been evolutionary. Maybe, says Professor Bhagwati, but given how he was once attacked for advocating capital controls, he's thrilled the IMF has finally come around.
Along the way, there were occasional indications, but never so frontally saying, golly, Bhagwati was right, and now they have.
I should make clear, Linda, Professor Bhagwati and other international economists still think the movement of capital around the world is generally good for the global economy, but conditions matter. Some countries are better prepared than others to handle an influx of foreign capital.
So a totally free market economy in this case is not such a good idea.
In this case, Linda, the countries that were most diligent about following all the free market rules actually fared worse than those countries that dared to challenge those rules.
Thanks, Tom.
You're welcome, Linda.
NPR's Tom Gjelten.
The recession is expanding American households. Young people are staying home with mom and dad. Grandparents are moving in, too. And the Pew Research Center says the bad economy is not the only reason. There are more homes filled with several generations. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
In a roomy townhouse in Northern Virginia, Ray Anderson stacks dinner plates in the dishwasher as his wife pours a cup of coffee and their 23-year-old daughter Jackie pours herself a glass of white wine.
Okay, I'm running out of space here.
Jackie just graduated from Penn State last year. Given the horrible job market, she knew she'd end up back with mom and dad. And really, there's no shame in that.
Most of my friends that are from high school are still around this area, and most of them do live with their parents as well, and I know a good number of them up in Pennsylvania do the same thing.
It's true, the recession has hit young adults especially hard, but Jackie's mother, Chris, says bad economy or no, she always expected her daughter to move back in.
I thought when she graduated that she would want to build up enough money to get a place of her own, get a car, get all the things that she wanted to live comfortably.
In fact, it turns out that 1980 was the high point for living on one's own. Since then, the Pew Research Center finds that the number of people in multi-generational households has grown by a third to 16% of the population, and young adults like Jackie are leading the way. Paul Taylor of the Pew Center sees a new cultural norm. Baby boomers may have come of age protesting just about every conviction their parents held, but he says that generation gap has virtually disappeared among their children, the so-called millennial generation.
It seems rather admiring of older adults, believes that older adults have values that are better than their own. At some level, they're becoming buddies with mom and dad, and they may not find it so unusual to still be living in their childhood bedroom.
Boomerang kids aren't the only ones driving the trend of extended family living. Older adults are also slightly more likely to share such households. Demographers say the generation that gave birth to the baby boomers has a lot more kids to potentially move in with. Another big factor, immigrants, a growing share of the population. Lawrence Yoon sees this at the National Association of Realtors.
Particularly among the Hispanic families, they are looking for a larger size home. And some of the Asian communities, they're just accustomed to living with grandparents, so they're just adopting it here as well in the U.S.
Yoon says home sales were the same last year as in 2000, even though the U.S. population grew by nearly 30 million. Clearly, he says, people are moving in with each other instead of buying their own homes. At the Anderson home in Northern Virginia, Jackie recently found a job and is planning to move out sometime.
I'm kind of playing it by ear. I'd like to do it maybe around the summer. That's a tentative date. I don't really know, but just whenever things work out.
Her dad says she'll have her parents' blessing when she goes, but they like having her around, and they're not going to give her the shove. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, Tiger Woods returns to golf. We'll ask why and what it means. But first, we go to Detroit, where the beleaguered city is shutting 44 of its public schools as it contends with steadily declining enrollment and a huge budget deficit. Detroit, of course, has been slammed by the downturn in the auto industry, as well as the economic downturn in general. Of course, it also has been suffering its unique political troubles. Here to talk more about this is Robert Bobb. He's the emergency financial manager for Detroit's public schools, and he's with us now from there. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us once again.
Thank you.
How did you make the decision to close 44 of the 172 public schools, and how did you decide which ones to close?
It was a very important decision based on the city's population. At one time in Detroit's history, the population was 1.6 million people. And today, Detroit's population is around 800,000, awaiting the results of the next census. We've had a decline in birth rates in our city. So we've seen a steady decline in our student population. In just 10 years ago, we had approximately 175,000 students. And so this year, we have 85,000. There is a movement on the part of the mayor to shrink the size of the city. There are some terrific neighborhoods in the city, but there are some neighborhoods that are significantly abandoned, and therefore, in choosing which schools to close, we've looked at, examined those neighborhoods where we have a steady population, and so we've consolidated a number of our elementary schools, and we've proposed to close a number of comprehensive high schools.
I get the picture. You're basically trying to shrink the city's footprint. One of the questions I had, though, is that schools aren't just buildings, they're kind of living organisms, there are relationships and networks, and obviously many times people have very strong feelings about those relationships based on their memory of going to that particular school, but I was interested to know whether how well the school functioned played a role in choosing whether to close it or not.
Where we consolidated schools, we moved entire programs from schools that have excellent and very strong programs into schools where the program has not been as strong. And so in areas where we're consolidating schools, we're not consolidating a school, a low-performing school, into a high-performing school. We're taking programs that have been very successful and bringing those programs into a school so that we can offer the successful programs to a larger number of students in a new neighborhood. And you're correct. There are relationships that have been built by neighborhoods and by individual buildings. We want to change the conversation from the discussion of a building to the discussion of the strength of the academic programs that will be housed in that building.
Do you think that this will be enough to staunch the bleeding, the financial bleeding?
Oh, yes, definitely. Well, just on the school closures, you know, last year I closed 29 schools, and this year on the table we have 44. But we have to recognize the fact that in Detroit we have a shrinking population. We have an expansion of charter and other schools. So parents have greater choices in where their children should be educated. We're also implementing a $500.5 million bond issue, which gives us an opportunity wherein we're renovating and building new schools or replacing schools. By the same time, we're also closing schools, but we're doing it in a very strategic way so that we can help to strengthen neighborhoods as opposed to continuing the abandonment of certain neighborhoods in the city of Detroit. But the city itself, it does have to become smaller than it has been in the past.
How are people reacting to this? I have to tell you, I received an email last night from a woman who is a graduate of Burton Elementary, and it was a very highly regarded elementary school, which was, I think, one of the first to offer the International Baccalaureate program. It was language intensive. It was just rigorous. I mean, she described a scene where people would line up around the block to try to get their children into the school, and she said very movingly that, you know, when I went to this school, I knew my life was going to change. And as I understand it, Burton is one of those slated for closing.
Burton International, its international baccalaureate program, is very strong and extremely successful. It is in a building that's sandwiched between a casino and another large property. The building itself needs significant renovation. So what we're doing is moving the entire Burton program into a school building where the facility itself will allow that program to grow and offer those children a real gymnasium, swimming pool. So we're not closing the Burden International Program. We're bringing the program into a much better facility and allowing that program to grow and to offer more opportunities for other students throughout the district.
So what I hear you saying is that you're trying to change the conversation from the buildings to what goes on in the building, to focus on the programs that are offered and the quality of the program offered as opposed to the specific location where it's offered. Do I have that right?
That's correct. In the case of Burton, it's an application school, and students attend that school from all across the city.
Okay, but the question I'm having is, do you think that the citizens of Detroit are willing to accept that? People tend to have a very emotional reaction to their schools, and I wonder if you feel that people are willing to accept your argument and the mayor's argument that this is what has to happen.
Well, I can tell you that there's a lot of anger on a part of some. There's a lot of uncertainty. I'm going to be hosting as many town hall meetings with individual schools and in neighborhoods that we can between now and the end of April. And those meetings are being scheduled. But yes, there, you know, people are concerned. There are a lot of concern. There's a lot of anger, and legitimately so. Parents want to know what's going to happen to their child, the type of facility that the children will be placed in. The plan that we've put on place takes away the uncertainty, and that is it's a 5-year master facilities plan, which gives the community a long view of what schools would be closed in the future if we continue to have the decline in the residential areas of those neighborhoods, as opposed to every year we come in and we said, oh, we're going to close X number of schools. But this plan this year gives the community a long view, a 5-year view. It also provides the community with the real data and demographics of what's happening in their community and in their neighborhood. There are certain areas of the city of Detroit where we have the population is exploding, and therefore we are not only building new schools, but we're renovating schools in certain parts of the community.
And finally, Detroit is not the only school district that is confronting this. The Kansas City, Missouri School District announced plans last week to shut down nearly half of its schools by the start of classes in the fall. DeKalb County and suburban Atlanta is considering closing 12 schools over the next 2 years to address a budget deficit. The officials in St. Louis are also considering similar steps. As a person who's worked in a number of jurisdictions across the country, what do you think this means?
What it means is that, you know, we are greatly impacted by the economy, and there really needs to be a way to really not only have the conversation around jumpstarting the economy, but it really needs a significant boost, particularly in our urban environments. The infrastructural needs in either urban cities and in Detroit, Kansas City, and others are so significant and massive until there really needs to be a massive infusion of not only local funds, but also state and federal. And of course, in the state of Michigan, the state is facing a significant deficit. The city of Detroit is facing a deficit. The Detroit Public Schools, we're working to bring the Detroit Public Schools out of about a $300 million legacy and current year's deficit as well. So, and then of course, the unemployment, there are significant challenges in these urban centers, and these urban centers are going to have a very laser-focused stimulus to turn the tide. And it's, the answer is not just charter schools, because we also have, you know, very low-performing charter schools as well. And so I just think that public education is going to be the mainstay, but we have to change, A, the conversation, and B, figure out ways in which we can provide some financial stability to these communities. And it's not just the competitive, you know, race to the top or some others. It's going to have to almost have to be a Katrina-like stimulus program, or a program similar to what happened in the Gulf states after Katrina in many of these urban centers. And I can speak in Detroit's case, because I can see the issues and the challenges that we face here in Detroit every day.
Robert Bobb is the Emergency Financial Manager for the Detroit Public Schools, and he was kind enough to join us from WDET in Detroit. And we thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.